Bucklew versus Hawkins, Mr. Rupert.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Don Rupert, appearing on behalf of the appellants, cross-appellees. This is an appeal from a final judgment entered by Judge Shabazz, the Western District of Wisconsin, involving copyright infringement and associated damages. Although there are a number of issues that were addressed in the party's briefs, I would like today to focus on certain aspects of three of them. Why the copyrights are invalid, why certain of Mr. Bucklew's forms were not infringed, even if the copyrights are valid, and why the damages in this case were unsupported.
Well, just to make sure we agree on some basics, you're not denying, are you, that you copied that form 52566?
We believe that there is evidence of copying of that form, but that raises another issue, and that is...
Well, that's a coy way to put it.
Well, you copied
that form.
We will agree with that, Your Honor, but from the copyright standpoint, whether or not that form was copied goes to the issue of whether there was a copyright, any protectable expression within that form that was copied.
Well, I don't understand that argument either, because, I mean, it's obviously modest expression, to say the least. But, you know, the bold face, the choice of the Swiss font, and the decision to retain the output range, even though you don't need it with a DSM. Now, that's the kind of modest expression we see. There's no particular reason not to protect that.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, as to those elements, the district court, first of all, concluded that the use of DSM itself was not protectable.
Oh, I understand that.
And when one applies with respect to...
I don't know what you mean by that. Your brief says that, but that's kind of like saying the use of the letter A is not protectable. Excel and Lotus offer a programming language. DSM is a formula in that programming language.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it's the equivalent of letters in English. You put formulas together to produce the program. Why does the fact that a given formula is not protectable mean that the program produced using that and other formulas is not protectable?
Well, in this case, Mr. Bucklew has never contended that he had any rights to DSM or even DSM within the use of a table.
Look, authors don't contend that they have any right to the letters of the alphabet, but they put them together to produce something new. So Shakespeare doesn't claim any right to the letter A, but does that mean that his plays couldn't have been copyrighted because they're made up exclusively of 26 letters?
Well, no, that doesn't mean that at all.
All right. So let's address the question whether one can have a copyright in a program written using formulas that are part of the programming language.
Well, certainly from a source code, object code standpoint, software programs are copyrightable. But we're not dealing with software programs here.
That's what a spreadsheet cell is. It's a program written in a programming language.
That's correct, Your Honor. But Mr. Bucklew wrote, if you will, not a program. He prepared a blank form table
that's
contained within his overall product.
That's what computer programs are. They are things that... logic instructions that mediate between inputs and outputs. That's what filling in the content of a cell in a spreadsheet does.
Correct.
Have you written a spreadsheet program?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Programming, right?
Yes.
So why isn't the contents of the cell copyrightable?
Well, the contents of the cell are merely using what's in the public domain already. That is...
No, I guess we're back to the letter A. If I write a program in Fortran, I use some combination of go to, conditional branch, unconditional branch, and loops.
Correct.
Right? None of the idea of an unconditional branch can't be copyrighted. The conditional branch can't be copyrighted. The do loop can't be copyrighted. That's all that's in my program, some combination of them. Does that mean my program can't be copyrighted?
Oh, absolutely not, because what you've done in your program with respect, Your Honor, is you have arranged those in a particular manner.
That's what Buckley did.
No, Your Honor, he didn't. What he did is, what we're talking about here is this blank form table, which we've, an example of which is found, I believe, on the top of page 7 of our gray brief.
And every one of these is an underlying cell, which is an underlying program, and it's, we have to take it for purposes of this deal, that every one of the underlying cell-based programs was copied.
And that's not something that Mr. Buckley contended with copied in this case. He contended merely that the blank form found in on the top of page 7 of the gray brief was copied.
Mr. Rupert, I am a person who uses a quill and ink.
Yes, ma'am.
So maybe you can help me with this. HAD claims that all of the advantage of Mr. Buckley's forms flowed from the use of the gsum function.
Yes, ma'am.
But some of the advantages that were claimed by a purchaser were that prior versions are saved automatically, that boxes are formatted to fit the size of the numbers, and a summary page could be completed. And it seems to me that these aren't inherent in the DSUM function,
well,
or are they?
Well, they are not exactly inherent in the DSUM function, but the problem, Your Honor, with respect, is that those aspects that you're referring to are found in the replicated government forms that are not at issue in this case. The only thing that's issue in this case is this blank form that's found in Mr. Buckley's product and found in Hab's product. And the question is whether there is anything protectable within that blank form itself. And if one looks at the merger doctrine, where Mr. Buckley's idea was to use DSUM, and the way he expressed that idea was the way that the Lotus and Excel manuals required.
I don't think the merger doctrine or the Sten affair have anything to do with this case. He made some choices which were not inevitable. They're not world-shaking, but, you know, this bold-faced business and the retention of the output range and the Swiss fonts, maybe some other things. Those are the choices he made, and your client copied them.
Well, with...
So it's like a map, right? You copy someone's map. Most of the map would be the same even if you did it from scratch, but you still can be an infringer.
It seems very damaging that your client had this identical use of the bold format in otherwise empty cells. What would be the explanation for the use of the bold formatting in empty cells?
I don't know that there was any explanation, Your Honor, quite honestly.
Except
perhaps copying.
Right.
With respect to the table found in form 52566, but that doesn't address the question on the remaining three tables, the 52567, 825,
and 867. Well, in relation to that, there's this question about Judge Shabazz's method of admitting exhibits, which I must say sounds very sensible to me. Are you saying that you didn't know that Judge Shabazz's policy is to not to fuss during the trial about admissibility, but to determine admissibility in advance and just permit objections as to relevance? Because you might have a document perfectly admissible in the sense that it's the best evidence and it's not hearsay and so on. It's authentic, but it turns out to be irrelevant because the issue to which it might relate just doesn't arise in trial. So that's his method. So are you saying you didn't know it was his method, so you were sandbagged?
Well, Your Honor, essentially, yes, that's what happened. If I might, Your Honor, at the pretrial conference, the judge said, here's an exhibit.
But are you telling me you just didn't know that this was Judge Shabazz's method?
I did not know it was Judge Shabazz's method.
Well, you have local counsel. Were they involved at all?
Yes, they were, Your Honor.
Well, Judge Shabazz says he's been using this method for 20 years.
Well, the concern...
Why didn't your local counsel tell you, you know, better watch out about these documents because they're going to be sent to the jury even if they are not mentioned during the trial?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Is this subject covered by anything that Judge Shabazz has written?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. What he said in his pretrial order was that exhibits to be offered at trial, and there were some of these forms were not exhibits that were offered at trial. There was no testimony concerning.
I had the opportunity to object to the admission of any documents prior to trial.
We have certainly had that opportunity, Your Honor, with respect to, for example, a copy of HABS Form 52835. Clearly, that copy, from the trial standpoint, would be relevant if there was testimony concerning that. But there was no testimony concerning that, and it was not presented to the jury.
Is your proposition that if a document is not discussed by witnesses, it's not admissible?
We refer to that in our brief, Your Honor. That it's not that it's not admissible,
right.
but it shouldn't go to the jury because there's
Wait a second. That doesn't make any sense. Look, a document, if it's an admissible document, suppose it's a business record. It's evidence. It doesn't have to be sponsored by a witness. If the parties agree this is an authentic business record, you can give it to the jury. You don't need a witness to talk about it.
Well, in this instance,
that idea.
In this instance, Your Honor, there were no witnesses that talked about any of these.
Yes, I know. But is it your proposition that documents can't be given to jurors unless witnesses talk about them?
We believe that's the case, Your Honor.
Now, wait a second. Do you have some authority for that breathtaking proposition
evidence? I believe we cited some in our blue brief, Your Honor, or perhaps the gray brief.
Is it U.S. versus Magna that you're thinking about?
I believe so.
Well, that case is really an opposite, because in that case, the judge had specifically ruled that unplayed tapes should not go to the jury, and the prosecutors defied the ruling. So that case is an opposite. But I can't think of any of the other ones that you might have.
You know, if I might turn just for a moment back to these last three forms of 825 and 837. Now, with respect to those, it is our position that no reasonable observer, under any theory advanced by Mr. Bucklew, would conclude that those forms infringed. The first theory that he advances is that HABS serially copied from the form 52566 to arrive at the 567, 825, and 837. But he presented no evidence to the jury comparing those latter three forms to his form 52566. And in our gray brief, I believe it's on pages 7 and 8, we've provided side-by-side comparisons of those forms. And again, under the ordinary observer test, we don't believe that any ordinary reasonable observer would conclude that the last three forms are substantially similar to Mr. Buckley's 52566.
It depends on your view that only the outward appearance of the forms is the subject of copyright.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, Mr. Bucklew's copyright applications and his registrations addressed screenshots.
Well, limited to copyright registrations in a copyright suit. The copyright registration matters only for the purpose of presumptive damages.
I understand that, Your Honor. Now, but with respect to the underlying macros or the underlying codes, there was no testimony at the trial even that any of these codes or macros found in any of the HAB forms were the same as or similar to any of those found in Mr. Buckley's forms. The other theory of infringement that Mr. Buckley proposes on page 24 of his brief is that HAB's form 52567 is substantially similar to his form 52567, and the same for the remaining two forms. However, again, that comparison was not made to the jury, and we've made that comparison in our gray brief on pages 8 and 9, and the forms are not substantially similar at all. They have no resemblance to each other. And with respect to Mr. Buckley's forms, as we discussed, all of the information found in them were taken directly from the Lotus user manuals, arranged as taught in the Lotus user manuals, or the government HUD forms themselves, arranged as taught in those forms.
Could I ask just an informational question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why does your 52566, why is your 52566 different from Buckley's?
It differs only in colors.
No, it doesn't. There's different headings.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's supposed to be a government form. I don't understand why.
With respect to the form itself, the government form, or with respect to the table? With respect to the table, the 52566 table, the headings there were taken originally by Mr. Buckley and by HAB from the government form 52566. It says management, modernization, etc., and it goes across. At one point in time, HAB changed the headings on the government forms because of some of its clients were using different types of government grants. And so if you look at the spreadsheet found on the HAB computer disk, you'll see headings that are different from the headings that are found on its table. And that's the reason for that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, you don't want to talk about damages?
Certainly. I've just entered my rebuttal.
About damages. Now, do I understand correctly that you've never argued that you can't have... I would have thought it was fundamental that if a copyright owner sues for the profits of the infringer, he can't at the same time ask for his own lost profits. But you don't seem to argue that.
No, we argue that with respect to actual damages. As the court appreciates, copyright damages are actual damages or the defendant's profits, but not double counting those two.
Where did you argue that?
With respect,
I mean, you're right, they're not. Where did you argue that duplication is?
I don't know that we actually addressed it from a duplication standpoint. We indicated in our brief that actual damages...
I don't understand you. I mean, obviously, if you made profits and they lost profits, it's because, you know, they would have made money, but you made the money instead. So that's one number. You can't add together your profit, their loss profit. But where did you say that?
In the briefs, we did not say that, Your Honor. What we said with respect to the actual damages amount that the court ultimately awarded was that there was no testimony to support that actual damage amount. Mr. Buckley testified...
Well, I understand that, but that's... Okay, she didn't argue that.
No.
If the court has no further questions...
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rupert. Mr. Van Camp?
May it please the court, counsel, Mr. and Mrs. Bucklew. I'd like to address the issues raised in the cross appeal.
I wouldn't waste my time with that.
Well,
this case is kind of a shambles, I must say. What is the evidence? I'm not bothered by his argument about, you know, didn't know what Judge Shabazz does with exhibits, but what actually is the evidence of copying for the other three documents?
There are two things. There's testimony by two different witnesses about copying appearing in those other documents.
But now take something like the boldface business. Now, those other three documents, do they have the boldface pattern in your documents?
In we're talking about the blank cells,
right?
I don't believe that they do,
because your expert Fisher, is that his name?
That's correct.
Your expert. Now, I gather his expert report was actually put into evidence.
That's correct.
Okay, but
both
even,
two reports.
I'm sorry.
There were two reports of his put into evidence.
Okay, put into evidence, but he didn't testify about the other forms. But even in his reports, it as I recall them, they're almost entirely about 52566. There's very little about the other forms.
That's correct. But there are references to the other forms in his report, and there also was testimony by Mr. Fisher about the
intention that the formulas used in those three other input tables were derived from the formulas in the original form.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Are you making an argument that the formulas in the tables in those three additional forms were copied?
Yeah, I believe they were. We're not making a claim to the formulas themselves.
But, you know, isn't all of this...
Excuse me, let me finish this. Is there evidence in the record that the contents of the cells was copied?
Yes.
Your adversary says there is no such evidence in the record.
Okay. Mr. Fisher...
So we need to figure out where it is in the record.
Okay, first of all, in Mr. Fisher's report, there are references to the other spreadsheets, 52825 and 52837. In his testimony on redirect on cross, he was specifically asked if there was any testimony or anything in his reports about evidence of copying those other spreadsheets, and he testified that there was. And also Mr. Bucklew himself testified on direct examination that he reviewed those programs and found evidence of copying in those other programs specifically by number.
Well, it seemed to me, it certainly appears, that Mr. Bucklew conceded at trial that HAB never had direct access to those three forms.
I don't believe there is any testimony by anyone that the defendants did not have access to those forms. On the contrary, Mr. Duran testified that his typical sale involved a PC Anywhere program. He also testified that some of the people who had his programs had Mr. Bucklew's programs as well, and that they would have access to them through PC Anywhere. Now, the problem is, of course, Mr. Bucklew developed all of these and used similar design parameters in terms of lines, fonts, bolding, things like that. He used all of those in all four of these programs. It's very difficult to tell precisely which one of those was copied. It appears, after all of the discovery in this case, that what happened was the defendants copied 52566, and then they serially copied that into later versions. When Mr. Blum was asked about that...
Then the question is whether what ends up is a derivative work. Right, suppose, to take Judge Posner's example of a map, suppose I completely copy somebody's map of Chicago, but then I revise it so that it becomes a map of Milwaukee. Is that a derivative work protected by the copyright in the map of Chicago?
Well, we're dealing with a term of art when we say copy, because in this case, copy is a computer command. They didn't simply look at his spreadsheets and decide to...
I don't care about the technology of the copying. In my map hypothetical, I am using a Xerox brand laser photocopier.
Okay.
Right, it makes something that's essentially identical to the original. And I now, using all sorts of devices, revise it so that basically all that's left is the coordinate grid, and I plop a map of Milwaukee down on it. Have I made a derivative work?
Again, it would depend on the specific details that were copied. And in this case...
I copied a map of Chicago, and I made it into a map of Milwaukee.
Well, if the copy of Milwaukee map has certain types of lines, certain
north,
types of print,
south,
certain type
east, west.
Well, I think that goes back to the discussion that you had with Mr. Rupert about the letter A. In this particular case, any given one of those might not be sufficient to demonstrate a copyright. But in this case, there were sufficient copying into each of those three subsequent forms.
I'm not asking you a question about these forms. I'm asking you a question about how much variation can one make and still have a derivative work. Right? If your theory is that they took the input table for form 556, et cetera,
right.
You've made a copy of that,
right.
And then cell by cell, border by border, you know, header by header, rewrote everything, except they ended up with boldface still being applied to the same blank cells that they didn't touch. Has that change gone so far that it's no longer a derivative work? And to answer that question, one has to know how much change is possible or required starting with an original before the work is no longer called derivative, even if you start with the original. That's what I'm trying to inquire of you.
Right. And given those parameters, the copies that were made of these three subsequent...
Stop talking about these three subsequent forms. Can you tell me what, in your view, is the answer to the general question, how much change is required before a copy is no longer a derivative work?
Substantial change is required. And I... Without specifics, it's difficult to determine whether that would be enough.
We need to state a general rule, and then we'll use that rule and apply it to the facts of this case. But if we don't know what the general rule is, we'll never be able to figure out how to resolve the facts of this case.
I'm taking you back to the three. I want to go back to my question about Mr. Bucklow's concession. Question, where do you believe the defendants obtained the database that they used in their 52567, 52825, and 52837? Answer, from Mr. Bucklew, I believe they obtained it from the 52566 form on the demo case.
Correct.
So he is relying on his claim that all of the databases infringe just the 52566?
Well, to the extent that the databases that he designed for the other three tables include many of the same design characteristics, they also infringe those. Now, the actual access is demonstrated, I think, beyond doubt as it relates to 52566. But those same characteristics appear in the other database tables.
But you see, I think your answer to Judge Easterbrook was, more or less, that given 52566, it would be very simple to make up additional forms which would just gather the data from another column. So instead of being salary, it would be other expenditures. That's fine. But the problem is, as I see it, that we really don't have, we don't know very much about these other forms. We don't know, for example, whether they actually have this same boldface problem, the Swiss fonts and all this business. So the alternative possibility is that he just used the idea of 52566 to generate his own separate forms for these other categories of expenditure.
Correct.
And that would be using the idea rather than the copy. So
correct. And were it not for Mr. Fisher's testimony that he found evidence of copying in those, were it not for Mr. Bucklew's testimony that he found evidence of copying, and were it not for the fact that the jury had the exhibits to compare themselves without objection, they were admitted, and they could themselves examine those. With that evidence in the record, and nothing to the contrary, I believe there is substantial evidence in the record to show that those were also copied. From a damage standpoint, it doesn't make any difference anyway.
Because well, why
if,
is that?
Because if the defendants copied the database from Mr. Bucklew and they put it in the four different packages that they market, they have stolen that database regardless of whether they got it from four different databases or from one.
No,
therefore, the...
But look, let me, since you mentioned damages,
yeah.
It seems to me you've got problems. Now, take something like one of your damage headings is that, or one of your damage theories is that Bucklew's income fell more or less at the time of the infringement. But don't you have to make, isn't it generally necessary in these cases to make some kind of apportionment of damages? So, for example, suppose they copied your 52566, as undoubtedly they did, But their sales success had to do with the fact, the way they promoted their product. They're a larger company, and they promote it, and their marketing activities generate their profits. So those wouldn't be profits due to your Buckley's intellectual property. So was there any discussion of that at the trial?
Well, as I understand the law of damages as it relates to this, the burden of proving that the damages were not related to this once the prima facie case is introduced is upon the defendant. And I think that that leads to one of the other issues here, and that is that the defendant's credibility, the witness's credibility of the various witnesses put on by the defendant, was terrible. And I think that the jury resolved issues of credibility in favor of the plaintiff. And they did that both with regard to the plaintiff's testimony about liability, but also damages. The defendants acknowledged that there are time savings. They acknowledged that they had sales. They acknowledged that they, the theory that, for example, the unrelated software sales would increase as a result of tying these forms, that was not a harebrained idea of the plaintiff's expert. Those were ideas that Duran, the executive vice president, agreed with. Those were Mr. Blum's very reasons for looking for the position with his employer, Habco. The Verana proposal states that this will occur, and in fact, it was that basis that was the basis for the damage testimony.
Mr. Van Camp,
yes.
According to the brief, HMS for Windows is a very expensive program, costing, you know, between $30,000 and $80,000. An organization is only going to buy the program if it needs it. And doesn't it seem unlikely that an organization would spend $30,000 minimum on HMS for Windows merely because it was bundled with this $2,500 HUD program?
Well, that sounds like a stretch, but I don't believe that it is. First of all, I think if you understand, there are two people who testify that the people most closely involved with the purchase of this software are the controllers. And they are the chief financial individuals in these housing authorities. They are the people who are responsible for filling out these forms. These forms are the nightmares that they face on an annual basis. So, yes, they do want financial software, and undoubtedly their executive directors are interested in that. But one of the depositions that was read into the testimony, as well as Mr. Buckley's own testimony, was very clearly that the controllers are the ones that are going to be making the decisions. I don't think it's a stretch at all to believe that they would be swayed to a software package that contains forms that will save them a lot of aggravation. So no, I don't believe that is a stretch. And it wasn't disputed at trial. There was no contrary evidence. Plus, it wasn't objected to when it was introduced. Very briefly, the Wisconsin State Punitive Damage Statute is a statute that governs conduct. It is not dependent upon the underlying theory.
The problem is that you have a real tail wagging the dog problem, that the conversion you rely on is the conversion of the CD.
But
what really you're worried about is not that you lost a little piece of plastic, but that your intellectual property was stolen, and that's copyright.
Well, first of all, I don't believe that the conversion or the fraud claim are required for application of the punitive damage statute. I believe it is intended to govern conduct, and if there was ever a situation where the conduct required governing, it is this one. As we pointed out in our brief,
garden variety copyright infringement.
This is a defendant whose appetite for copying other people's software and selling it is unabated. This is a defendant, the same defendant.
There are criminal penalties under federal copyright law also, I suppose, for very bad people. So
Well, I agree with that. But there are also civil remedies provided by state law. That state law is not excluded under the Copyright Act. It applies perfectly to this situation. The Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin reduced the punitive damages awarded by a jury from $1,750,000 to $650,000. And when they did that, they stated $650,000 is plenty to punish and deter. It didn't do that. There is a statute in place in Wisconsin that would provide punitive damages in this instance, and there would be an amount that would deter and punish. Finally, as to the RICO, I also think very clearly there is a pattern here. There are all of the elements for a RICO. The pattern occurred within 10 years. The trial court unfortunately focused on the act, if you will.
But it's a little worrisome because, you know, we have we have this company, I think it must be a Chicago company, PIL, I don't know what it stands for anymore, but they're sued for copyright infringement frequently, and sometimes they lose. And they then, under your theory, become a RICO violator. I mean, anybody who's in the publishing business is probably going to be sued from time to time, or maybe anybody in the software business is going to be sued occasionally for copyright infringement and will lose occasionally.
There is no question that intentional copyright infringement is a predicate act. I mean, that, I think, is a given. That's the state of the law. So it is an appropriate application in this case. In this case, there are two totally separate defendants. There were two totally different injuries. They occurred within the appropriate time frame.
Well, you call them totally separate, huh? They're not totally separate. They're similar.
Management Computer Service was a completely different scheme, and in both of those cases, both
they're not affiliated companies?
No, not at all.
There's no relation between them?
No, there is not. In both cases, there were findings by the court that the taking of the software was intentional. There is one in this case. There is one in the MCS case. And those lay the foundation for a RICO act. And I believe that... I'm sorry? I believe that this court should apply it in this case to deter this defendant from copying other people's software. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Van Camp. Mr. Roop, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, the Hab and Hawkins-Aish Baptie companies that are appellants in this case are related. Hab, Inc. is a subsidiary of Hawkins-Aish Baptie. Mr. Van Camp made reference to the Bucklew forms, and on page 19 of Mr. Bucklew's brief, he says that really what he considers to be the protectable elements, again, are the fonts, location of color, column headings, table layout, and construction. We've identified those in our brief and why we feel that there is no protectable expression associated with them, either under the merger doctrine or the sins of fair doctrine. Going to one question to Mr. Van Camp relative to the HMS.
You lost me there.
I'm sorry.
What did you say? What does it have to do with page 19?
Of Mr. Bucklew's brief.
Look at page 19.
Yes.
Yep.
He indicates the original element, the other original elements, such as fonts, location of color, column headings, and the table construction and
right.
Layout.
And what's your complaint?
And my point is that with respect to those, we've commented in our briefs that both merger and sins of fair would render those particular elements unprotectable.
No, because, look, there's a choice of fonts, right?
Correct.
You make a choice, and what you choose is part of the package, right? Your original package.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why isn't that protectable?
Well, it's one of the things that the court might seek guidance from is the Ninth Circuit case that we cited in our citation to supplemental authority, which is a Satava versus Lowry case. And in that case, they looked at a combination of unprotectable elements and indicated that that type of combination is protectable if the elements are numerous enough and their selection and arrangement are original enough to give rise to originality. And here the selection...
The requirement of originality is absolutely minimal in copyright.
Well, here the selection of originality was based upon the appearance of the original HUD forms published by the government and the use of the DSUM function. If I can go to one question that was addressed to Mr. Van Camp relative to the HMS for Windows product and the damages. Mr. Van Camp referred to some testimony, and he said about a purchaser. The purchaser he's referring to is Mr. Mark Switz, who was one of Mr. Buckley's witnesses by deposition. Mr. Switz had never purchased an HMS for Windows product from HAB, and there is no testimony in the record as to why anyone purchased HMS for Windows for any reason. With respect to the comment from Judge Easterbrook earlier about the letter A and the various...
equally applicable, by the way, to the letter B.
Or C, yes, Your Honor, I understand that. Again, the Tava case from the Ninth Circuit, we suggest, provides guidance as to whether that letter or a series of letters, when arranged in a particular fashion, would give rise to copyright protectability. Thank you very much,
okay,
Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rupert. Thank you to both counsel.